came along from Michigan and Harlem and all them brown towns. Rising tide lifts all boats. David Duke got all our votes. Everything is fine in Gina. There ain't a single thing that a white can do that a black can't do in Gina too, except live in a nice house on a nice street. Accumulated wealth over generations, you can't call that a racist nation. Everything's fine in Gina. Well, we don't have a race problem here. It's not about color, it's about crime and fear. Black kids want to sit on a white tree. Sounds to me like a crime spree. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I can end your life with a stroke of a pen. Everything is fine, Gina. Tell me you don't do the same, cause your New York Bell had a different name. Michael's in jail, Sean's 6 feet under. So it goes, that's the situation. You can't call that a racist nation. Everything is fine in Gina. Used to have an underground railroad, now we railroad them here at home. Just because it's a prettified plantation. Can't call that a racist nation, everything is fine. Can't call that a racist nation, everything is fine in Gina.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to What to Do About Climate Change with Tom Ashbrook, who talks with Vicky Arroyo and Anthony Lucewitz.
We are going to hit some sort of a climate wall. That is now indisputable. And we're already beginning to see the impacts, and we have, we're going to see more.
But what does that mean, hit a climate wall? I mean, people may say, well, I don't know. We'll have to move back a mile from the seashore. We'll have to, live underground. I don't know what it will be, but right. Humans survive. You listen to Ben. He's ready to survive.
Well, the point is how fast do we hit that wall? And that's really my key point here. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between hitting a wall at about 10 miles an hour, in which case you end up with some bumps and bruises and maybe a mild case of whiplash. Versus hitting the wall at 70 or 80 miles an hour. And that's really the choice that we have before us. We need to put on the brakes, absolutely, because it will make a huge difference. But at the same time, we need to be essentially buckling ourselves in and getting ready and building more resiliency in our communities, because many of them were built with the assumption that the climate would be the way it was in the past. And as we're seeing, as things change, these structures, our homes, our roads, our bridges, our hospitals, and so on, have been built in a world that really isn't going to exist in the future. And we need to take action now to protect them.
But the question there is, Vicky, for individuals, are you buying solar panels or are you buying a diesel generator? So when the power grid goes out, you've got yours.
Well, it's a good question. And my family lost their homes in Katrina, so I've seen the personal toll that storms take on people. And I do think that we all need to look at our communities and our own lives and our own investments and say, what is in store? And if you live along the coast, it makes sense to perhaps consider retreating over time or rebuilding or building differently, certainly after a storm or a flood event, looking at how we can minimize urban heat island impacts of climate change by painting our roofs white to be more reflective. And that saves energy, and it also helps to cool the building, or planting gardens on roofs. You have a green roof, then it actually cools the whole neighborhood as well as your own individual home. So some of the policies that you would put in place to adapt to climate change also have a mitigation benefit.
Where are we in the arc of, if we're on this arc of climate change, where are we in it? I mean, how much increase is already baked into the future, and how much can be forestalled or put off? The goal was to keep it under a 2 degrees Celsius change. Now I'm seeing people talk about, flying right past that. Is that already, and that could be catastrophic in many areas. Where are we on that arc, Vicky? How much climate change can be put off at this point, and how much is just baked in the cake already?
Well, I mean, I think the recent World Bank report that you alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. in IEA, the International Energy Administration, our agency, says that the world is heading to more like a 4 or 6 degree Celsius rise if we stay on our current trajectory, as opposed to stopping at 2 degrees, which is what the world was trying to work together collectively.
And what does that difference mean?
Well, I mean, it means that we really are likely to see very significant rises in sea level rise, maybe not in a very, very long period of time, but even over the next century. And I think it does make it difficult for those who are trying to advise people about how to plan accordingly. You know, the truth is that we really are dealing outside of the bounds of human experience here. We can look back in, you know, the millions and millions of year record and see that there have been very dramatic changes. We were not around to experience them, but now we might very well be. And so we really do have to look hard at what we can do to cope in a relatively short amount of time with dramatic change. And when you consider all the people who live around the world, not just in our country, in large urban areas around the coast, that's a pretty significant expense to try to figure out what to do with all these people who are going to be vulnerable. You can't just put up seawalls to solve this problem.
The World Bank chief outlining implications of a 4-degree centigrade increase in temps, at looking at, you know, sort of ticking them off: inundation of coastal cities, increasing risks for food production, unprecedented heat waves, substantially exacerbated water scarcity, more frequent high-intensity tropical cyclones, hurricanes, irreversible loss of biodiversity. But Tony, that's if, as Vicky says, we say in a kind of a straight line increase, or the path we're on now. What's doable? You're just back from Doha, the big UN conference there. I don't know how hopeful that is, but how much of that arc could we pull back from and still avoid?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that when you look at, for instance, the climate projections of will we end up at a 2-degree, 4-degree, 6-degree world. And by the way, if we hit 4 degrees, that is definitely a world that none of us wants to live in or have our children live in. And thinking of 6 degrees is, it's actually unthinkable.
Paint the world. What's it look like, the 4-degree,
oh
5, 6?
I mean, you're talking about massive disruption in natural ecosystems, massive disruption in our food supply, in the water supply. The middle part of the world will become much drier. We probably have well past loss of the Amazon rainforest. We may see major shifts in things like the monsoon system that is the primary source of water for the entire Indian and Southeast Asian subcontinent.
So you're talking masses of people on the move, desperate, everything that comes with that.
It's not a place you want to live.
And we're on that path? Is that what I heard Vicky say?
We are currently on that path. But the biggest source of uncertainty in these climate projections, and I cannot say this strongly enough, is that we don't know yet how human beings are going to act. It is totally within our control to choose what kind of future we want. So that's really the challenge for human beings, is what do we want out of that future? And what choices are we willing to make now to get this future that we would prefer?
Can we still stay in that 2% hike range if we do what it takes?
Yeah, I mean, certainly all the experts that study this say that many of the technologies that we need to actually stay right at about 2 degrees are already in hand. Now, the longer we wait, the bigger and harder it gets, because there are lag times into this system. It's not like simply, you know, shutting off a coal-fired power plant and suddenly the air gets cleaner in that city. CO2 goes up in the atmosphere and it stays up there for at least 100 years. And so, you know, the climate we're experiencing right now is in essence the CO2 and other greenhouse gases that were emitted, you know, several generations ago. Meanwhile, the CO2 we're putting in the air now is going to have a lasting impact in future years. So that's why it's so imperative that we begin taking action immediately to forestall the damage that's going to be done later down the road.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the climate change outlook and attitudes in this country and around the world after the crazy, scary weather of 2012. Anthony Leiserwitz is with us from Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut. Vicky Arroyo from the Georgetown Climate Center in Washington, D.C. Want to look at paths ahead, but a couple callers here. Zenon's calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Zenon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I think what bothers me about this conversation is that we are missing an essential demographic. I keep hearing you talk about those who don't believe in global warming and people who believe in it and are panicked. But we're missing a huge demographic, which is people who accept that global warming is happening and welcome it with open arms.
I like the fact that
the temperatures are rising. I like the fact that the Arctic shipping lanes are opening. This is going to lead to more commerce, to lower prices. Sure, the coasts might be adversely affected, but that means inland areas are going to see their property values go up. That means inhospitable areas are going to become hospitable.
So embrace the change, idea. You say, Zine. Embrace the change. Roll with it. Is that it?
Absolutely. Change is the human nature and capitalism is of such a nature that we adapt to change. If the Connecticut's become the Carolinas, fantastic. If we have more drought, then perhaps we start exploiting the natural resources in the Great Lakes.
Zine, let us pick it up. Let us pick it up right there, Tony Lazarowitz. Hey, this rocks. Let's roll with it. What do you say, Tony?
Oh, my. Well, first of all, I would say that contrary to his claim, we see that's actually a very small minority opinion in this country. It's certainly less than 10%, and I would say it's probably more around 1% or 2%. Nonetheless, I think we have to admit and be clear that there are always going to be some pluses, and in this case, however, many minuses. But there will be a few pluses. As things get warmer, you're going to pay less probably for winter energy bills because you won't have to heat your house as much. Yes, the Arctic will open to shipping lanes. On the other hand, that's exposing one of the world's most vulnerable ecosystems to large-scale commercial traffic. It's opening up huge reservoirs of additional fossil fuel and carbon burning as companies start trying to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean, not just in the rest of offshore of the United States. And what that really ignores is the fact that all of our systems are built for the current climate system. They're not built for the system that's coming. And that we are all embedded in these globally now interlinked systems of food and water and health and security systems that are completely dependent on the system as it exists today, the climate system that exists today. To suddenly shift and wrench the world into a different kind of food production system, that's just not going to happen. If we lose the breadbasket of the United States, as an example, you can't just go farm in Alaska. There is no topsoil in Alaska, and it doesn't change the way that the sun's light hits the earth. It comes at an extreme angle in the North Pole. So even though that's by temperature a place where you could grow food, you literally can't grow food there.
But you can hear the adaptive human psychology looking for ways to say, let's go with this, Tony.
Well, to one extent, we're going to have no choice. We are going to have to adapt, and we will. I don't think that's a major question. The question, though, is to what are we going to adapt? Are we going to adapt to something that is a moderate change, like 2 degrees, which, by the way, even 2 degrees is still going to be difficult to adapt to?
Yep.
Or are we going to try to adapt to some really extreme changes, like 3, 4, 5, or 6 degrees?
I'll bring it to you, Vicky. Let's get a call here from Mandeville, Louisiana. Maurice is calling. Hi, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Awesome. I've been a fan and a listener for a long time.
Great.
This just seemed like the issue to call in on.
Great.
Mandeville is about 30 minutes from New Orleans, so
okay.
Clearly, we've seen tons of weather, good, bad, and the ugly, over the years. And I don't think the argument is so much whether or not the climate is changing. We've had barometers and thermometers for, hundreds of years now.
Yeah.
The thing is perspective. My belief is that it's a selfish human instinct to think that that we have the potential to do all of this on our own, to do all the damage that we're doing, when frankly 15 minutes of volcanic activity puts out more greenhouse gases than all of human civilization can do in a year. It's not that we're not contributing, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't work toward a much greener future.
Yeah.
I think it's really just selfish of us to think that it's all our fault.
Or kind of egotistical, kind of human-centric to think that we're doing it all. What about the scientists who say we are, Maurice? You write them off?
Well, it's not. The thing is, they can't go back hundreds of years and check out what's supposed to happen. They can only see the results. And so, we're pointing fingers at cars and cows and all that. And I understand that those are definitely contributing matters. But like I said, you get a volcanic eruption and it totally changes the balance.
You look at the change and you want to feel some humility, but then there is that scientific consensus that it's happening and we're at the heart of it. Vicky, what do you say to Maurice, who just can't believe that we little humans are really the rudder, that's turning this ship?
Well, I can understand that instinct, but the truth is that there is a scientific fact base here. And in fact, the scientists can look at proxies like ice cores and tree rings and see what has happened over generations and how greenhouse gas emissions from other causes over millennia have driven the climate system. And we're the ones who are now, you know, digging the fossil fuels out of the ground and putting it up in the air. And so the rate of change is as disturbing as anything else. And, you know, so to the previous caller's point about being able to adapt, I mean, all of this isn't going to go smoothly, as we've seen with some of these storms. And there's a tremendous amount of human suffering. There's also natural systems to worry about and animal life and ocean acidification that comes from putting CO2 in the atmosphere and having it fall into the oceans and turn into carbonic acid and affect the lives of shellfish and things like that. So, you know, we really can't be sanguine about this. And just on the particular point about volcanic activity, the truth is that on balance, volcanic activity actually has a cooling effect. In fact, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, I'm a board member who oversees that organization through UCAR, their parent corporation, actually had been asked during the Bush years to do some scenarios about simulating volcanic eruptions by adding particulate matter to the atmosphere because it actually temporarily cools the planet. So it's just not true that greenhouse gases are not driving this warming and that those greenhouse gases aren't primarily coming from human activity, mainly fossil fuel burning, but also, importantly, other greenhouse gas contributions that even have higher global warming potential, like refrigerants or methane. And these are things that we can actually curb in the short run. And, you know, in talking about solutions, I think those are some of the things that we should look towards.
I want to look at those. I mean, myself, I kind of like the natural world. I'm pretty fiercely fond of it. And I don't know how much I want to just see you blown away. Rebecca, Franklin, Tennessee. Rebecca, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm well. What do you think? What are you thinking as you listen to all this, Rebecca?
Well, you know, I do believe that global warming is happening. I do believe that humans have had a great effect on it. But as an individual who wants to make a difference, it's incredibly overwhelming to try to figure out where you begin as an individual, what changes you need to make in your daily life. And then on the flip side of that is that, you know, I guess some of those, the options are rather expensive if there are certain things in your life that
yep.
you purchases that you make that you need to change. And then are they convenient, you know? And I think that's another aspect of it is kind of the selfishness of, well, how much is it going to change, you know, my efforts in my day-to-day to be more mindful?
You know, I think a lot of people have exactly that in mind, Rebecca. We'll go right to that if you'll permit me. Let me get one more call, and we'll go to it. Let me hold that, Rebecca. One more. Matt in Lexington, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that one of the problems that we have is the scale of the change that your experts and many believe is necessary for us to avoid the worst consequences of global warming is just so difficult to get people to change their behavior when that behavior may conflict with underlying value systems, you know, whether they are economic or spiritual or whatnot, that I think, you know, one thing that gets left out of the conversation is tying in how the behavioral changes affect the values that we hold, you know, in terms of freedom and being able to get in your car and drive off wherever you want to. Those things need to get examined when we're talking about the science, too.
Let me take that perspective and Rebecca's to the challenge here. Vicki, I mean, there's the question, you know, are we up to this behaviorally as a species? I mean, Rebecca asks about it in individual lives. What about cost and convenience? Matt's looking at the scale of it, and it can look overwhelming. Are we up to this? And describe for us, you know, what would it take? What's it going to take to begin to put the brakes on this more effectively, Vicki, policy-wise?
Well, so it can look daunting, but government plays a role, right? And if you look at the fuel economy standards that we put in place under the first Obama term, the automobile efficiency standards, they're going to be able to save people money at the pump. At the same time, we're reducing dramatically not only our dependence on foreign oil, but the greenhouse gases that we're pumping into the atmosphere. And so building on what he did his first term on transportation, we can move over and look at what EPA can now do using existing authority without Congress.
But everybody says that's great, but that wasn't nearly enough. There's going to have to be a lot more. Like what? How soon? What?
Well, power plants. I mean, so power plants are responsible for roughly 40% of our emissions. We can curb the emissions from power plants. We haven't had standards in the past. EPA proposed standards for new sources of CO2 from power plants.
Curb them by shutting them down? But how?
No. So their standards for new sources that they proposed basically require emissions at the level of a clean natural gas facility.
Okay.
So for coal plants, they either phase out if they're too inefficient, or they capture the CO2 and sequester it in the ground. That's, you know, a technology option.
Yep. Carbon
capture. there are technologies. As Tony said, there are technologies that are available.
Take us on. So there's mileage, there's power plants. What else is it going to take? Matt is imagining, you know, challenges to our everyday ways of living that people may find unacceptable or difficult.
But what's interesting, if you look, we at the Georgetown Climate Center, we work a lot with states, and governors have articulated why to do this, not just because they're on the front lines and they're seeing the consequences of not acting on climate change, but they're seeing opportunities for things like renewable energy and efficiency to plow money back into their economies and to create new jobs.
So you're talking alternative energy sources. What about in our daily lives? If we are going to get on top of this, are we going to live different lives than we live now? Are they going to be in some fundamental ways? What?
Well, I mean, technology is part of it. And so the car that you drive might be different from the car that you otherwise would drive.
Yeah.
But you know, if we change where the power comes from, do you know where the electrons in your own home come from? I don't think necessarily. And I think a lot of people
prefer
it to come
from. There's your power plants. Take us on.
Right. So, I mean, some of it might come in the form of driving less. And the way that you can try to achieve that is to price carbon. That's something that people have been talking about for a long time.
A carbon
the
tax.
Need to have some kind of carbon tax. And given the fiscal cliff discussions, given the deficit discussions, you know, maybe we
might
could talk about also relieving, you know, other tax burdens. But tax a bad instead of a good. Tax what we burn as opposed to what we earn, as I think Al Gore is saying right now.
What about the cost of all this? Is it going to further bring down our standard of living to pay for these changes?
Well, so some of the states that actually have these policies in place, like the New England and Mid-Atlantic states that have a cap-and-trade program in place, have done a study that actually shows that the fact that they've taken money from a cap-and-trade program and reinvested it in their economy has actually created jobs and benefited their GDP in that region.
So it can work that way. Tony, what do you say about human adaptability here? Is this beyond us?
Oh, I don't think it's beyond us. It is a question mostly of politics. But I'd like to come back to Rebecca's point. You know, it's easy to get overwhelmed by the size and scale of this, because it is. It's the kind of a problem that we've rarely faced before as a species. But first, we have to recognize that there is no silver bullet. It's going to take silver buckshot, or if I use a different metaphor, it's an all hands on deck kind of moment. It's akin to the kind of effort that the United States put forward when it came to winning World War II. You know, there are times in human history when we are willing to band together because we all see we have a common threat. And in this case, we also have a common opportunity. This is our chance to define and to build the sustainable world that we want to live in. That'll actually not just be the status quo world that we live in now, but actually a better world, a cleaner world, a healthier world.
Yeah, that's hallelujah. But there's politics, as you say, right in the middle of it. Fossil fuels have been pretty effective in muddying the waters around this issue. Where do you see that going? I mean, every time I turn on the TV, I see these big ads for, you know, this great oil future or carbon future that's coming.
Right. But that's what's actually really interesting, is that despite all the millions of dollars that the fossil fuel industry has spent to try to promote their brand, so to speak, it hasn't really taken hold. The vast majority of Americans still see fossil fuels, especially coal and oil, as very dirty and polluting, whereas they have just the opposite view of the alternatives, like solar and wind. And in fact, when we ask Americans, should the U.S. be using more renewables or more fossil fuels, they overwhelmingly, and this is a cross-partisan line, say that we should be using more renewable energy. And in fact, they want that renewable energy now. I think people are actually, there's far more consensus in the United States than most of us recognize around the goal of this clean and healthier energy future. Because remember, it's not just about climate change. Those coal-fired power plants put out lots of other particulates that cause asthma, that cause respiratory disease, have all kinds of negative health impacts on their local communities.
Vicky, China, India, all the rest, I mean, even if the U.S. does it, what about that side of the ledger? It's huge and it's all the same global pot.
No, that's true. And China is actually taking action. They have had aggressive car standards in place even before we were able to deal with ours. They are experimenting with cap and trade at the regional level within China. But no doubt that we have to engage China in bilateral agreements to reduce our emissions collectively and other major emitters like India. But, you know, the U.S. is obviously a global leader as well. We contributed to more of the emissions that have caused warming historically up until this point. And, you know, we want to be a leader. We need to be a leader. And there are some advantages to leading, because you can develop the technologies that can then be exported to the rest of the world.
So watch Doha for some of that and all the conversations coming up in the years ahead. Maybe developed countries cut back sooner. Developing, they're saying maybe cut back a little later. But on balance, maybe we can hit that mark. Is there a point of no return here, or is it always a moving target, Vicky?
Well, you know, we're learning more all the time. And having worked on this issue for some time, I have to say the surprises are mostly cutting in the direction of, you know, making us more alarmed, frankly.
The ice melting faster, the temperatures going up, the seas rising. Got our attention this year. We're paying attention. Maybe there's a big shift underway. We will see. Vicky Arroyo at the Georgetown Climate Center in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for joining us, Vicky.
Thanks, Tom.
And Tony Leiserwitz in New Haven, Connecticut. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, come on, all you big, strong men.
Uncle Sam, need your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam. Way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, like a two, like a three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates.
Come on, General, let's move fast. The old big chance has come at last. Gotta go out, get those reds. The only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when the throne of all the kingdom come.
And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
Just hope and pray that if they drop the bomb, they drop it on the Viet Cong.
And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
Well, come on, brothers, throughout the land. Pack your boys up to Vietnam. Come on, folks, don't hesitate. Send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box.
And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.